Well, you live and learn, and you die and forget. Work smarter, not harder. Those were some wise sayings or proverbs that were spoken to me from some very influential men in my life. The first was from my grandfather on my dad's side. He was a very jolly man, happy guy, loved life. And he would say this often when a mistake had been made or my dad or myself was regretting something that we had done. He'd say, "Well, Dustin, you know, you live and learn, you die and forget." And it was just his way of saying, "You're making too big of a deal out about this. Just let it go. It'll be okay." The second saying, "Work smarter, not harder," was taught by my grandfather on my mother's side. And he lived across the street from me, hardworking man who worked on the railroad for many years, but he also had a small cattle farm. And I learned a lot about hard work from him. And he said this often. And so one of my earliest memories of learning this proverb of work smarter, not harder, was when he had brought a huge pile of lumber home from some building that was demolished or something that he was going to repurpose. And he hired me and my brother to pull nails out of those that stack of lumber for the summer. And I can remember struggling with that claw hammer, trying to get those nails. And he grabs a crowbar, he grabs a block of wood, teaches me how to use that block of wood and that crowbar, you know, as a fulcrum to pull those nails and make the job much easier. And there were many projects that I learned from him over the years on working on that farm of how to work smarter and not harder. And so his words come to me often. Even a few years ago, my own children had decided they wanted to dig a fish pond in the backyard. And so Julie and I consented, and I come home from work, and they have dug a huge hole, 10, 12 feet by like 5, 6 feet. And they got through the topsoil just fine, and the only tool that I had in the shed was a round point shovel and a square point shovel. And I looked at them and said, "Y'all are working too hard." Loaded them up, took them to Southern States. We bought a mattock and a pickaxe and brought that home. And in a couple of days, that hole was dug. So they learned how to work smarter and not harder. But that's the beauty of a proverb. Leland Ryken, who is a professor at Wheaton for many years, has a book about the Proverbs. It's titled Short Sentences Long Remembered. And he says, "The strength of the proverb is its conciseness. It expresses truth with a punch." Truth with a punch. I like that. Most notable of the proverbs like that are found in the book of Proverbs. You may have some that are coming to your mind right now. One is Proverbs 1:10, "My son, if sinners entice, do not consent." Or Proverbs 3, 4 and 5, or 5 and 6, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge him, for he will direct your paths." Now today we're turning again to the book of Psalms, Psalms 127. And the lines of this song could easily be inserted into the book of Proverbs. They give great insight on how we should build and live our lives. Let me read today's text. Psalms 127, a song of ascents of Solomon. "Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil. For he gives his beloved sleep. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb, a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate." So Psalms 127 is found in a section of 15 psalms in the Psalter known as the Song of Ascents. There's several different views of when these songs may have been sung, but the generally accepted view is that these songs were sung by pilgrims as they traveled to Jerusalem to participate in the three annual feasts that were required in the Old Testament. That would be Passover, Pentecost, and the Festival of Booths or Tabernacles. They're called the Song of Ascents because You had to travel up in elevation to reach Jerusalem. It sits well over 2,000 feet high up on a hill, is the city of Jerusalem. And these songs were sung by worshipers, the faithful, headed to Jerusalem to worship God at the temple. I like to think of Jesus and his family with Mary and Joseph there in the end of Luke chapter 2. We know that Mary and Joseph lost Jesus, and he was in the temple. And I like to think, I don't know this if they sung this song or not, but I like to think of that, Jesus singing this song with his family as he traveled to Jerusalem to worship God. My family have been blessed by some of these songs in the Song of Ascents. I think of Psalms 122. It says, I was happy when they said unto me, let us go into the house of the Lord. And I did hear Pastor Jim's sermon last week, so I'm not going to sing. But my children and I used to sing those words in a little song that we learned. I actually learned it overseas, a beautiful song of going into the Lord. And we used to sing it every Sunday morning as we traveled to church. Maybe Psalms 121, I lift up my eyes into the hills, and where does my help come? My help cometh from the Lord. That's a song that's been put to music, one of the Psalms that's been put to music that some of you know. And we see here that Solomon is the author of this psalm. He knew a little thing or two about building. He built the temple. David wasn't allowed to build the temple for God, but Solomon was. And so Solomon was tasked with that. He also knew a few things about protecting a city. He was the king, and his responsibility was to protect those in the city. And I'm sure he knew a thing or two about children. We know that he had a lot of wives, 700. We also know that Solomon had a lot of insight into wisdom. When he dedicated the temple, he asked this request of the Lord, that the Lord give him wisdom. And this is the Lord's answer to him. He said in 1 Kings 3:12, he says, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you. So Solomon, this great wise king, has written this song for us today to reflect on. First observation I want to make is this, and that's verses 1 and 2. We see that life's activities done without complete and total dependence on God are done in vain. These verses show the sovereignty of God in three pursuits of life: that of building a house or building a home, that of protecting a city, and that of the way we earn a living or a vocation. And verse 1 is simply saying something twice in a very similar grammatical form, but using different words or images. Both statements say the same thing. That is, if you find yourself occupied with things that are not ordered rightly, centered around God, and dependent upon Him, they are done in vain. In vain is used three times here in these two verses, so we should pay attention to that. If you've ever read the book of Ecclesiastes, which was also written by Solomon, you know that Solomon used that word often. It would vanity, and it would sometimes refer to a man's actions as either fleeting or like a vapor or chasing after the wind. Sometimes it has the meaning of just being empty or meaningless or even incomprehensible. But in studying this passage, I realized that, as one commentator pointed out, that it's not the same word that's used in Ecclesiastes. Here in this psalm, the word has moral connotations. He even goes on to say it's permissible to go as far as saying that this vanity that Solomon speaks of is wickedness. The lexicon defines the word as worthless, vanity. An example of this would be in Jeremiah chapter 6, and there the word in vain is used to describe the actions of Israel. Their actions were worthless, for they did not purge out the wicked that was among them. And in that one verse, it talks about in vain, the refiners of gold and silver continued to make idols to worship rather than worshiping God. Now, the passage is not here as well to give us an excuse to be lazy. The carpenter still has to pick up the hammer. The night watchman can't use this verse as an excuse to take a nap on a shift. No, both the builder and the watchman must do their part. Verse 2, we see that it's in vain that you rise up early, go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. Now, I personally like to get up early. I rise around 4:30, 5 o'clock most mornings, even when I can sleep in. It's just become habit. And that's because I do my best work, my best thinking, I'm most productive in the mornings. I know some people that are just the opposite. They're night owls. But this text isn't here to give the, you know, maybe the teenager excuse of, "Dad, I can sleep in." Or for the night owl to not go, you know, ask that they can not be told to go to bed. No, it's warning here to us against extending the hours of the workday. Rising early, going to bed late is unnatural. And we weren't created for it. We weren't designed to work all the time. It's not sustainable. But because of worry and anxiety, we can find ourselves working all the time, trying to meet our needs and not being dependent upon the Lord. And that's simply evidence of not depending upon God. And so a great reminder to us that sleep is good. It's a gift from God. I even remember Pastor Jim in one of Psalms 2, I think it was, or one of the early Psalms that he preached a few weeks ago. He talked about how sleep is good. It's a gift of the Lord. So these two verses at the beginning of Psalms 127 remind us to be dependent upon God. Independence from Him translates into vanity. In God's economy, self-sufficient living is foolishness. And as growing disciples, if you're a follower of Jesus in here, you should see yourself as a growing disciple, being more and more dependent upon Him each and every day. But if you find yourself relying on self, relying on your own experience, your own wisdom, your own expertise, then why is that? And what can you do about it? What needs to change? I'll give you two suggestions, and here they are. One is to pray more. This week in our Wednesday night ministry, our kids memorize a verse every week, and this week we're focusing on 1 Peter 5:7, which says this, "Casting all your anxieties on Him because He cares for you." So pray more. I joined our students this year, and Pastor Derek's encouraged them to read through the Bible this year, and he's given them a 5-day Bible reading plan. And I just this week finished up 1 Samuel. And the last few, 10, 15 chapters of 1 Samuel, you have all these troubles that David's facing because of Saul pursuing him. And Jim's mentioned that again in some of his sermons recently, but we know David faced all these problems. And one of the things I noticed in my daily Bible reading is this, that David often inquired of the Lord. He asked of the Lord. He sought the Lord before he would go into battle, before he would travel to the next town. So what an example for us. Every decision that he's making there, we see him consulting the Lord and waiting on the Lord to answer him. So pray more. Another suggestion that would help you to become more dependent upon God is to maybe take a break, take a Sabbath. Take a rest. The word Sabbath means that. Stop. It means stop. And again, I know in New Testament times, I'm not saying we should take Sabbaths like they did in the Old Testament, but think about, are you just going, 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 going? Are you always doing, 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 doing? Reflect on that. Think about that. Do I need to take a rest? The best biblical example of seeing people trying to do things on their own without God is back in Genesis 11, the Tower of Babel story, which most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with. They were trying to make a name for themselves, building this tower. And God quickly says, "Let us go down and confuse their language. Let's scatter them." Because what they were doing was evil. It's not what He had purposed for them. Now, the second part of this Psalms, we see there's even a paragraph break there. And maybe in your just a cursory reading of this, you would say, what's the connection between verses 1 and 2 and verse 3 where it says, you know, unless the Lord builds the house, and then this, behold, children are a heritage, a gift from the Lord. Well, I believe it's dependency. In the future, these parents that would be reading this verse needed to depend on their children, these blessings, these gifts from God, to support them, and specifically to defend them and to provide justice for them. In the ancient world, your sons were your future. And the more you had, the better to defend yourself and to defeat your enemies. So just as a warrior can use his arrows to fight the battle for himself, the father who has trained his sons well, fashioned them as well-tamed arrows will have them in his time of need. He can depend upon them. Surely this has instructions or instructive truth for us Christians today, those who are parenting today. But before I go too deep into that, I do want to say this about the subject of children being a blessing. There's no reason to doubt that if you don't have children or haven't been blessed with many children, that you are not blessed. God chooses to bless children in many ways. I mean, to bless his people many ways other than children. But we shouldn't judge people or judge ourselves based on God's blessings on the abundance of children or the lack of children. But the Bible does make it clear that children are a blessing or a heritage from the Lord, a gift. Certainly not how our culture views children today. To many, children are not a blessing. They are seen as a burden. And I could illustrate that in many ways. You're probably thinking of some ways. Maybe they're seen as financial burdens, career burdens. I'll tell you one of a personal example. Julie and I, when we were first married, living in North Carolina, and I was going to seminary there. We had no children at the time. And I remember Julie coming home from work one day, and she was telling me about this lady she worked with, this young lady. Her and her husband were part of a club called the No Kidding Club. And it was a social club for people who did not want children, who did not desire children. And the way she described it was a club for people who didn't want to be inconvenienced by going to social settings with people that had children. Now, what made this extremely difficult for Julie was that she and I wanted a family. And we were struggling with infertility at the time. So it was very hurtful for her, and I was just surprised. But it showed that there's no value, at least in this couple of minds, of wanting to be with children. And we loved it. We loved being around people from our church that had kids and the blessing that they were. So here at Staples Mill and in this church, we must see the blessing of children and love and support them and their families. If you see a faithful family in this church having a lot of kids, encourage them. Don't discourage them with negative comments. And I will say this about myself because I know I've probably thought it, and I pray that I've never said it to one of these couples, is that, you know, the questions like, how are you going to feed them? Or how are you going to send them all to college? That communicates burden, not blessing. And children are a blessing from the Lord. And especially if these parents are faithful and raising their children in the instruction of the Lord, have many. Have lots of them. I've heard it said that children are a way of sending yourself into the future. And I had something happen just last week that really made me think about this, because I was on the quad of my kids' school meeting someone for the first time, and he and I were talking, and my son Cole came up. And I introduced Cole to this gentleman, and the man said, "You could be your dad. You look just like him." And he said, "But much younger." He said, "Let me make sure you understand. Much younger version of your dad." You know, that's so true. We see the family resemblance in our children or in relatives. Just today, there was a grandfather here of one of these that were being dedicated. And when I first met him out in the hall, I knew who his son was. But are looks the only thing that we want to send into the future? What else do we need to send into the future? Is it our love and devotion to our favorite sport, our favorite hobby, our favorite team? Is it a positive or negative personality trait? And I hope my kids don't pick up some of mine, but I see it in them sometimes. What about your faith? Your dependence upon God. Are you sending that into the future? This metaphor here in verse 4, where it says, like arrows in the hands of a warrior, can help us with this. Dan Phillips, in his book on God's wisdom in the Proverbs, asks this of arrows. He says, what does one do with an arrow? Does one just polish it, shine it, treat its feathers, and admire it? Does one aim at keeping it in one's quiver forever? Just happy to know it's there? Does one set it on the ground and say, go get him, boy, hit the target. That's it, that a boy. No, those are silly suggestions. We know in reality the purpose of an arrow is to be shot at a target. And as new covenant followers of Jesus, we should be asking, what is our target? What's our goal in parenting? What's our goal for our children? How should we be shaping our arrows? I'm no expert in ancient weaponry, how they made their arrows, but they weren't allowed to go out to Bass Pro Shop and pick them up, I'm assuming. They had to be shaped. They had to be made to be shot with accuracy. Chap Bettis wrote a book called The Disciple Making Parenting. And in that book, he talks about what the goal or the aim of parents, Christian parents, should be. And he says it's the Great Commission, Matthew 28, 18 through 20. Passages like Ephesians 6 and Deuteronomy 6, those are wonderful parenting passages. And I share them many times at parent-child dedication and talk to them about parents. But this goal of the Great Commission as being our, he calls it our North Star of parenting, should be to make disciples. And think about that, North Star. For hundreds, if not thousands of years, it has guided sailors across oceans. It has guided travelers across continents, even slaves escaping slavery to freedom. So, North Star of parenting, make disciples. He says this, obeying it, the Great Commission, should orient all we do as parents. We discipline our children not so that they will make us happy, but so that they will serve Christ as adults. We educate them not so that they have a good job, but to develop them to be the best follower of Jesus that they can be. We work hard to prepare them not for graduation day, but for judgment day. So how do we make disciples of our children? How do you make disciples of your children? First, you have to prioritize what is most important. You have to do some soul searching. You have to be real honest with yourself. Is God the most important thing to me? And a good way to evaluate that is to look at your life and to look at your calendar. Our calendar will tell us quickly what we value and what you're teaching your kids to value. This morning, during the 9:30 parent-child dedication service, I did something new, started a new tradition here at the church. I handed the parents a relay baton like this one. And it has the inscription of Psalm 78, 6 and 7 on it, where it says this, that the next generation should set their hope in God. And in the parenting class that I have with the opportunity I have with these parents before then, I talked to them about how this baton represents the gospel and God's promises that can be found in Jesus Christ. And they have a responsibility, even they are commanded to pass their faith on to their children. But again, I don't want them to think this is some formula or some magic steps that they should follow unless the Lord builds the house. They have to know that. They have to rely upon Him for their strengths to help them with that task and see the sovereignty of God. Now, I enjoy track and field events, and one of the most exciting things for me when I used to coach track, and even just last week, I got to go watch some kids run, is the 4x100 meter relay race. And that typically comes at the end of a track event. And almost all coaches will tell you the most important thing of that 4x100 meter relay is the handoff. Because you can have the fastest 100 meter runner in the world on your team, but if you drop the baton, you're disqualified. You lose. So you have to practice the handoff. But most people, some may know this, may not know this, but there's this area called the exchange zone as well. It's 30 meters long, and if you don't pass the baton in that length of time, you're also disqualified. And so if you're a parent here today of young children, let me tell you, passing off the baton, the gospel to your kids, it's important that you do it in that exchange zone. Now, the Lord can do it anytime, but that exchange zone is the time when you have them under your roof. Their formative years, their developmental years. And so teach them all you can about the Lord during that time. Make sure God is priority as you talk to them about Him. But I also would say there's also something we need to understand that's different than the track and field analogy with the exchange zone, is that we have an enemy. We have a world that doesn't want to see us pass off this baton to our children. And so at a track meet, the spectators stay in the stands. They're just watching this, but in reality, with spiritual reality, you know, we have an enemy that wants to stand in the lane, wants to throw things and hurl things at us as parents,
to keep put any obstacle in our way that would keep us from passing off this baton. So as a parent, if you're a parent of young children today, I would encourage you to keep your eye on the goal. Make disciples. Church, if you're here and hearing this message, know that you have a role in that as well. You can help. We as a church should be doing all that we can do to support our families and children. We will be depending upon them someday to be obedient to the Great Commission, this task of making disciples of all nations. So what can you do to help children? What can you do to help parents? Well, one's obvious. You can teach them. You can serve them. You can be involved in their lives, whether that's in a, you know, one of our programs here with our children's ministry, our students' ministry, or it could be that you just, through your life group, you're mentoring and helping parents. Young parents need us, need those that have come before us. And so I encourage you to do that. I've been really encouraged the last year or two from one of our life groups here at the church. They asked me how they could partner with our children more and our teachers more. And so there was a lot of work to be done around the church. So some ladies from that group came up and organized closets and cleaned out things for me. And so that was a real blessing. But the other part of it said, I want y'all to pray for our children and our students and our teachers. And so now, it's usually twice a year, couples from that class will visit our classrooms on Sunday morning, and they will pray with the teachers. They will pray with the kids. And I know this life group, when I have needs, I send it to a lady in that group, and they pray for our children's ministry. So that's just one way I see our church supporting and loving our children here at the church. You've heard it said as well that if anything's worth doing, it's worth doing right. And summing up my sermon today, I would change that well-known saying to this. If you're going to do anything, you must do it with God. That's what I believe the message of 127 is telling us today. If you attempt to accomplish things in life without God, doing it on your own, without His guidance, it is in vain. And I would be missing my aim in this message today if I didn't point you to Jesus, if I didn't point you to the gospel of Jesus Christ, the good news that's found in Him. To be totally dependent upon God, you have to first surrender your life to Him. You have to turn from this self-sufficient, sinful life and turn to Him by placing your faith and trust in His Son, Jesus Christ. Jesus said it best in John 15:5. He said, apart from me, you can do nothing. At the end of His Sermon on the Mount, He says this, everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. I started this message today with two short sentences that have been long remembered in my memory from my grandfathers. And I'm thankful for those. Now I want to close today by sharing a short Latin phrase that I don't expect you to remember, but it's this, Nisi Dominus Frustra. It's an abbreviation of Psalms 127:1, and it's inscribed on buildings throughout the world and the motto of many organizations and schools. The phrase simply translates, without God, frustration. Without God, it is in vain. G. Campbell Morgan, an evangelist and preacher from the last century, said this about these words. These would be splendid words to cut into granite over the entrance to all our homes and to emblazon in gold in all the meeting places of those in civic authority. But better still, let them be written in the heart of those who make homes and guard and govern cities. Unless the Lord builds the house, vanity. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for the truths that are found in your word. This wisdom of Solomon, that unless we build our lives on you, that it is vanity. God, I know we all in this room try to build many different things, whether it's our families, whether it's our careers, whether it's our ministries, Lord, we must understand that we cannot do these without you. We thank you so much that you're a God who wants to bless those who depend upon you, those who rely upon you, and seek you for instruction and for wisdom and for guidance. God, I pray that you forgive me this morning for those times when I've tried to do things on my own without your consent, without your help. God, I pray that anything that we build as a church, we build as individuals, that they would be with you and in you so that you can, God, be blessed and honored. Lord, I pray again this morning for these young families in our church that dedicated their children today. God, may this help them as they build their homes. May that be true of all of us. Lord, help us to rely upon you for all things. It's in Christ's name I pray. Amen.